This is the oral history interview with Captain Freddy Lichtaam. It is today, the 8th of February, and we are somewhere in the Southern Ocean. Are we still in the Southern Ocean?
Yes, South Atlantic. We're just coming up the Greenwich Meridian on 60 degrees south. We will be entering the 50s soon, and as you can see, the weather is not very good. The Arctic is also not being very good, but anyway, heading in the right direction, that's the most important.
Now, my first question is just your own path to, how can one say, in this sense, the ocean to Marion and Prince Edward Islands, or Antarctica or Gulf. How did your career take you there?
Well, it was strange. I always wanted to be aircraft pilot, and I initially did that for small aircraft. And my interest was always sort of adventurous, you know, flying and ships and things like that. But I eventually went to sea with the Beers Marine to be able to pay for the studies becoming a pilot. And then, I don't know, the bug just bit me and I continued being at sea. But I always read, even as a cadet going working for the Beers Marine Mine, I read about the Gallus and trips down to the south and to Antarctica. I always said to myself, now that is where I want to be. And I just got the opportunity because the wife of a senior driller on one of the ships that I worked for Smith, which was Pento at that stage. Okay. And I got to meet her there, and she offered me a job on Alcoa, which was sort of part of this division, if you want to call it that. And next moment I resigned 7 years later and came to Pento then in 2001, September. And my first ice trip was in December 2001.
As third officer.
Yeah, but I came. I was sort of de-ranked to. I de-ranked myself to actually come on that voyage, because I was already a chief officer in my previous company, and I was chief officer with this company. But I said to them, I'll take the pay cut, to do this voyage. Yeah, and then I stuck on the ship for years following.
And the captain during your first voyage?
It was Kevin Tate. Captain Kevin Tate, and. Captain Dave Hall was at that stage chief officer.
Okay. So that was in 2002, your first ice trip.
2001, December.
Can you still remember your first impressions of Antarctica?
Yeah, it was just always exciting, you know. It was, the weather was always horrendous, but that's to be expected. But yeah, seeing the first iceberg, I mean, you still had those film type cameras, and you took your first reel just on your first iceberg, and you know, you realized afterwards that was such a waste.
Yeah.
And but you know, it was exciting, and I enjoyed it every minute of it. I think if you know, as you become through the years and more senior, it becomes a bit monotonous because it's a long trip. But there's always a surprise. You always learn something new, which is nice.
Like
this trip was extraordinary. To all of us, and I mean between Dave and myself, we have almost what 18 years of experience if you add it up. And Shelton himself is also quite a senior guy for down here. But anyways, we didn't find much ice. The sea temperature was high. We had lots of snow. The swell up against the shelf was absolutely amazing. It was huge, which made our work against the ice extremely difficult. And lots of large sections of the ice shelf broke away. Now, we've got a couple of theories, but I think you need to have a professional opinion from a glaciologist or somebody like that to tell you exactly why the ice shelf is breaking away in sections like that. But in the previous year, massive icebergs struck the areas that we were working in and probably caused some energy to go through it and crack sections up. And that is why it started breaking. Due to the energy of the water, there was no sea ice out there to stop the swell. The swell came in and sort of broke away the ice shelf, which is absolutely amazing and dangerous. And I tell you what, I'm definitely 20 years older than when we left Cape Town. I took 2 days now to recover from that last 2 days worth of cargo work. Was, you know, slamming the ship up against the ice shelf like that is like somebody just punching in the ribs the whole time.
Yeah, you feel so, because
I mean, if you think about the ship is designed with hydraulics, engineering, electronics, and everything shudders with the ship. So, I mean, the chances of things going haywire and people getting injured is high, and, you know, you always keep that in the back of your mind thinking, and it, unfortunately, there's no other way for us to do the heavy lifts. You have to do the heavy lifts up against the ice shelf.
Even the Kamov can't do those things.
Grammar can lift 5 tons. We need to lift on 25.
5 tons. And the ship itself is not a new one. So.
Yeah, she doesn't have the features that we'll have on a new ship where we will be able to sit off the ice shelf on DP and work the cargo. So you have to physically maneuver her, and her machinery is not that reliable and responsive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she was built in 1977, a few years late. So she's old, and you know, you handle her with great care, soft, and don't want things to break. But still, she does a job. She did an amazing job. Mm. And again, she pulled it through, you know, so it's an amazing ship.
Amazing ship, yeah. And your first trip to Marin Island?
The following year in 2002 then, in April. But we came back from that Sanai cruise to the Neumaya cruise, because we used to do a Neumaya charter directly. Mm. So basically, you'll do a Sanai cruise, come back, discharge and load within 5 days and come back to Nantes. Mm. Do the Neumaya discharge and come straight back.
So how long did that take, all in all?
Well, your Sanai voyage will be like this one, which is typically 72 days. Then you'll get back to Cape Town, load 5 days, and you'll steam in, discharge 1 day, and steam out. So it's 10 days there and 10 days back. So you're looking at about 21 days for a Mangmai cruise, after your Sanai cruise.
Was it very different working for the Germans than South Africans?
Yes, the cargo for the Germans are just 20-foot containers. They don't have freight bulk. Like we have, you know, skidovers and drums and this and that. So it's a simple loading plan, it's a simple discharge plan.
So why is the South African plan not simple?
Because they don't have their base close to the ice shelf. And also, they don't containerize everything, because they put it on sleds.
To the
Germans...
Sanai.
Yeah, to Sanai. And they need to drag it all the way to Sanai, which is 80 miles away. So I suppose they could containerize things, but then you're not left with the option of being able to fly cargo off, which at times you would want to do.
And
I suppose containerization sort of wastes a little bit of space, you know. You can't fully pack a container always.
Mm. So your first Marion trip was then that year after, during April.
April 2002.
Is a Marion trip, in your experience, very different to an Antarctica trip in terms of the duties that the ship has to perform?
Yeah, I think, you know, you don't have the ice navigation aspect, but with Marion, you've got the dangers of uncharted areas. Marion is still very poorly charted, and there's uncharted rocks in some of the areas there. And I mean, up to even last year, we discovered new anchorages, which we never thought we'd be able to reach. The weather at Marion, Marion is situated past 40 degrees, so it's directly in the path of the major depression systems. So Marion's weather was almost pretty much always crap. You know? Heavy weather, especially in the winter months.
Mm-hmm.
So you prepare in the back of your mind for that, you know. You prepare for bad weather there rather than ice conditions. You know? So, but the Sanai cruise is the most challenging one, if you want to call it that. The challenging thing at Marion is refueling the island. You know, you have to put a open moor, and you're sitting very close to the rocks, and it's a difficult operation. Mm-hmm. Because it's a volcanic island, it doesn't have a long stretch of topography underneath that sits out, and you can anchor deeply, and you have to anchor straight next to the hostile rock face, and it's not a nice feeling for any mariner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, again, we prepare the new vessel for that sort of eventualities, to have a system where you can sit on DP, which is a dynamic positioning system.
Mm.
And I think that will assist us in that sort of process.
Speaking about the new vessel, in what capacity are you giving advice? Is it in your capacity as someone with expertise, or as a representative of Schmidt? Or?
Yeah, I think it is a bit of both. The department formed a small group of elected members for the planning of the thing. I was fortunate to be the master on this ship at that stage, and I've got a lot of experience on this vessel. So they just used me in the capacity of being available from Smith already on the ship. So, and eventually I was nominated by the DG for participating in the program. So now I've been, between me and Dave and some of the engineers, we've been involved fully with the program from the start, which is nice. You've got a team of people that's been involved right from the start, from the request for information document, and we're going to probably take it through to the end, hopefully.
Hopefully. And going to Finland? Have you been to Finland?
No, I haven't been to Finland.
Rocket?
No, I haven't. I've just been in conference call. That's an elected date because he's a contractor and he's retired from seafaring, actually. And because of his experience, they've elected him to represent the tech department, if you want to call it that. So he's been doing that trip, and then they'll conference call us via Skype, and then we'll give them advice from this side. So we did it like that, but I'm scheduled to go on the 1st of September to see the last of the fitment of the equipment on board, and then to take the ship out for trials, probably in one of the North Seas there, Baltic or whatever. It all depends on exactly what they want to test. Mm-hmm. So they're obviously going to want to test the ice capability of the ship, so they need to look for ice-covered waters. And then I'll probably bring the ship down. You know, that was the last word that I've had, okay. And I'm looking forward to that.
Would it be your first experience seafaring in the Northern Seas?
No, I've sailed on container vessels, and I've not quite up that far north, but I've been to east and west, North America, Mexico, Canada.
Okay, so you have experience in northern polar waters. Well, not polar waters.
Not polar waters. I did about 2 years on container vessels,
okay,
as a junior officer to gain further sea time. And I did also the Far East, Japan, and Taiwan, and China, and all those places at some stage of my life.
How different is a container vessel to this?
Well, it's more commercialized, you know. You've got a lot of pressure. I think as an old man, I don't know what junior officer there, so I wouldn't exactly know what the pressure is like, but I would think that, you know, you've got a certain time that you need to be at B, if you started from A. And I think that pressure sometimes makes you do things that is not you know, safe or speed that you're not required to do and all those kind of things. But I don't fancy the commercial industry where you're just counting boxes on an open line. You know, perhaps the areas that you visit is interesting, but then again, I've been to Hong Kong, I don't know, maybe 5 times, and I never went ashore because the time there is only, what, 6 hours, and then you go again. So I prefer the science and the oceanography and the logistics that we do here and the challenges that we have on the DEA type ships, you know, like the oceanography vessels and this ice navigation vessel. So I've served on most of the ships in this company. I also enjoyed the mining ships. That's also a total different fish. But I enjoyed that.
Speaking of this as an ice navigation vessel, what exactly is the Gallus? Is it a passenger vessel, a cargo vessel, a research ship?
It's a multi-purpose vessel.
Multi-purpose vessel.
Yeah. And it's classified as a passenger vessel, but in the way of the rules, it cannot actually be a passenger vessel because it carries low flammable liquid fuel. And no passenger ship is actually allowed to do that. But between Lloyd's and SAMHSA, Lloyd's is the classification society and SAMHSA is the sort of flag state authority. They've come to sort of a compromise, and SAMHSA sees us as a cargo vessel, Lloyd sees us as a passenger vessel. So between the lot of them, we just follow whatever the rules they apply.
Right, okay.
We don't have a choice. We need to supply the space with the people. With the people and with the fuel. You need both. So it's difficult to then get a ship like that. They are working on an actual special vessel classification. But you see, when you get to the numbers of 100 passengers, it becomes a passenger ship either which way. So we've actually, with the new ship, we've had a couple of challenges on how exactly we are going to apply these rules. And they've come to a couple of compromises where they say, right, you'll have to have an inert system around this polar diesel tanks and so forth. So it becomes a bit more technical and complicated.
In terms of science, do the gullets actually get taken out on dedicated science journeys, or is it mostly voyages, or is it mostly logistic?
Yeah, mostly logistic, hardly ever. We've done one or two ornithological type voyages where you've got the ship covered with bird watchers and they just go maybe sail past Marion.
Were you on that voyage where they took the bird watchers past Marion?
Yeah, and you know, but what you find is during any logistical voyage, there will be a scientific part of it. Like on this voyage, we did the buoy run, but the buoy run was added on with the oceanography work. So at some section, we stopped at the buoy run, we continued with the oceanography section. So it is written as part of the voyage. It's mm-hmm. not only logistics. It's combined.
That bird watching voyage, what was that like? Did you have to do things differently in terms of the passengers, or was that?
No, look, they wanted to go past Marion because they wanted to see the Albatry and they wanted to experience some of the Southern Ocean birds that they didn't normally get to see. And then they wanted to get into the ice. So we sailed past Marion down into the closest sea ice that we could get. One day in there, and then we came around back to Cape Town.
Were they paid passengers?
Paid passengers. I think it was the institute, it was the Ornithological Institute that paid for it, and then they made a certain price for the passengers to pay for it to cover most of the cost. But it was an interesting voyage with interesting people. It was a difficult voyage because the ship's one roll damp tank didn't work properly, so it was an uncomfortable voyage. I remember that clearly. But other than that, it was interesting.
Interesting. Exactly how does the relationship work between the DEA and Schmidt and the crew?
Well, we all work for Schmidt and Mandler Marine, right? Which is a third-party man and management company. So we man the vessel and we manage the vessel for them. And to do this, we ask a certain fee. Right? I don't know exactly exactly how much and how it works. But what I know is that Smith asks the management fee, DEA pays for it, and in that management fee certain things will be included, like we will keep the vessel certified, we'll keep the vessel seaworthy, we'll keep the vessel manned. So DEA doesn't have nothing to worry about except to get their people ready, their cargo ready, and pay for the fuel. I think the fuel is a separate thing, you know, the ship needs fuel. And the insurance, it's covered by Smith from the personal point of view, like D&I, but the ship itself is insured through DEA.
Okay.
It remains their ship, it's their property, we just man and manage it for it.
So the other ships are also DEA?
They're DAF now. They've changed department.
Department of Agricultural Affairs, Fisheries.
Fisheries and Forestry. Forestry and Fisheries.
But this one remains DEA.
Environmental Affairs, for now.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. Do you think it will change now that it falls on the oceans and coasts?
There's talk about it, but I don't think it will happen because DEA has manned and managed the bases, and they coordinate everything. So I don't see how, unless there's an institute, a scientific institute formed, where they take charge of them, maybe through the Department of Science and Technology. They take charge of the ship and the new ship, and I think I don't know really how they're going to work it. There's a couple of ways to do it, but I don't think it will shift.
Okay.
Not in the near future, anyway.
In the time you've been working on, the Ogalis as officer and master, has something changed in terms of the passengers that you could notice?
The passengers change every trip. But the hierarchy stays pretty much the same. It's always DCOs we all know because they're from the department, and we work right next door to them on East Pier. So we see them on a regular basis. But the scientific staff from time to time becomes familiar and similar because of the same projects, like the sealers on Marion, and some of the ornithologists like Peter Ryan, Stephen Chown, and those guys. You know, so. I mean, Isabel from the oceanographers, Sebastian. So there's a couple of guys that remain the same, but the youngsters and the understudies, they always change. You know, you always get new people on the ship.
But there's no significant change that you can see that they're getting younger or anything like that?
No.
Or mixed?
No. There's sometimes you'll get more females, sometimes you won't. There's not really been a major change that I've noticed, no.
Have you noticed any changes in the environment on Marion or on Gulf and Antarctica?
Yeah, I think there's definitely evidence that global warming is doing something, or there's some peaking period that we are going through, because, I mean, you find less and less ice, more icebergs, which means, you know, this trip anyways. And even at Marion, we've seen presentations from Stephen Stephen Chan, where there was a glacier still running on the side of Marion, and there's nothing there now. So what exactly is happening there, I don't know.
Have you been on shore on all the islands in Antarctica?
Yep.
To the bases? Have you been to Sinai?
Yes.
When did you go to Sinai?
2006.
2006.
When, just shortly after the that one guy died, there was a kiddo.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is that like for the master to of a vessel? Because obviously you're also involved in that kind of
it's sad, you know. I mean, it's similar to what happened to Yamnik, and the thing is, I've knew both those guys personally.
Mm.
I wasn't with Diebold, I wasn't the master, I was the chief officer at that stage. But I spoke to him in the morning and said to him, cheers, enjoy your year, because he was the day behind. I don't know where he was actually staying behind, but he said he's from the Hermanus Magnetic Observatory, and no, he was going to stay behind.
Yeah, he was going to have a team.
Mm. Yeah. And that afternoon, we took him off the helicopter and put him in one of the freezers. It was sad, man.
Yeah.
It was, the feeling on the ship was awkward, and people didn't even want to go down to that hole. You know, you get some people that are, I don't know, superstitious, I suppose. But for me, it was just sad.
So did you actually have to go fetch him? Is that why you went to the base?
No. But I had to carry him into the fridge. I was there helping the guys carry him in the end. It was preparing the fridge and so forth. And we actually had to do a long section of the voyage with him in the fridge, which was also a bit
kind of
weird.
Weird,
But, and then with Yamnik also, I thought he was a great guy. I got to know him, and when I read it in the news, it was sad to read that. And I think people don't always realize how hostile Antarctica really is, you know. In my opinion, you cannot be too careful.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose sometimes that's a little bit conservative, I suppose. But I'd rather be conservative than... Especially with my guys, you know, I always tell them I'm not here to win a popularity contest. I'm not here for you guys to like me. I'm here to make sure that you can have both your hands and feet attached to your body when you kiss your wife alone. When you get back home, and that's my main priority. If I didn't do that, then there's something wrong. You know what I mean? And I think this trip was very dicey in that way, because I could never guarantee myself Sayers and these guys are going to be okay, because there's blocks and things swinging around, cargo weighing 25 tons swinging around like it's no tomorrow. And so it wasn't, it was tough, and I'm just glad we
came. On the way home.
We're on our way home. I'm glad we came off okay, and I'm happy for it.
Rescue operations, what are they like? I mean, you've done a couple of either that you got sent out of South Africa. You did the Marion.
Yeah, I did the Kauri Dancer as chief officer, and I did the medevac as master. For the one that fell in the water.
Mm-mm.
The Kauri Dancer one was the most interesting one, because there's the first time that we did rendezvous calculations that we got taught at Tech to do, and to actually apply the search and rescue patterns, and to then search for the missing person and to estimate the drift rates. What was fortunate for us is just shortly before it happened is we actually worked in that area. We went to Marion, and then we went up there and did scientific runs in exactly the area that this happened. When we came back to Marion, we were there for a couple of days when these guys sailed across it. So we knew what the currents and the predominant drift rates were. So I strongly felt after that trip also to go and speak to the authorities, because I feel that people are allowed to take yachts, I mean, even single-handedly take yachts and sail across to wherever they want to. And the regulations don't regulate them properly. I mean, they don't have equips on them, they're not properly manned, they're not properly trained. I mean, the one woman that we saved there, okay, she was the best off, but she never even sailed on a yacht before.
Wow.
So there were three. The skipper, no, there were four. The skipper, he broke his femur when he got shunted across off the deck and onto the most of the ships with like a little coop decky thing there in the back there. Broke his femur. Then they took him in. The other guy took over the wheel, and he got shunted off when they broached for the, I don't know how many times they broached, but they broached again, and the railing that he attached his harness to broke off, and he went off. and he wasn't found again. The other guy had quite a bad head injury, and the lady, she was okay, but she was also bruised up.
Mm-mm-mm.
You can see when you went into that yacht, everything was turned upside down.
What did you do with the yacht?
We scuttled the yacht.
Scuttled.
Yeah, when we got there, we got them out and put them on a rescue boat. Sent the second mate and the medic to just point the yacht in the right direction so it doesn't roll so much. And we gave them a couple of shots just to relax them and seasickness and so forth. And then
a rescue boat? Sorry, what?
The FRC.
Oh, okay.
The fast rescue boat. I was driving the fast rescue boat. So then we put him on a big orange stretcher. This is a solid stretcher. And then we put him across the boat like that. And then we brought him onto the ship. And then just brought the rescue boat up to the level of the hospital, opened the aft hospital doors, and just carried him straight into the hospital like that.
Oh, I didn't know you could even do that.
Yeah, we did that.
Off the hospital doors.
Yeah. And on the poop deck.
Did you use the helicopters as well?
No. We used the helicopters just to land the guys initially there. But we couldn't use the helicopters too much because the masts were still upright on the yacht,
okay.
So you'll get everything tangled up there. And it was getting dark, so we were working in darkness when we rescued them.
It must have been very...
It was exciting.
Exciting.
There was about a 3-meter swell with about 20 knots of wind, so the conditions weren't perfect, and it was dark. But we used the ship's first lights, and the captain maneuvered the vessel straight up to the yacht, and I mean, we were okay. It was interesting and exciting.
And did you go immediately to Cape Town after that?
No, we hang around for about 2-3 days in search of the other guy.
Yeah.
And the life raft, because the life raft also broke off, but we don't know whether it's actually inflated or not. And we did search patterns with the ship and two helicopters. But after 2 days we couldn't find
it. But after that, did you go to Cape Town or did you go back to Marion?
I went back to Marion.
Yeah,
we had to still finish our work there. But we kept those guys on board.
It wasn't stable
enough, so we did our work at Marion, finished, and then
was Petrus the medic on that one?
No, it was Tom.
Tom.
From Brits. I don't remember his surname, but we just called him from Tom from Brits.
Tom from Brits.
Because he came from Brits.
Okay. Moving on to something completely different. The reputation of the Gallus in the maritime community, South Africa. What is the reputation of the Gallus? I mean, when people speak...
It's a prestige perception of the ship. If you think about the ship, you've got this prestige thinking of accomplishment and challenge and adverse conditions and adventure.
Mm.
In the same breath, I must say that in 2007, when the one guy stabbed the other guy to death, In my personal opinion, the ship got a very big knock. And, you know, it was a very uncalled for event, and it doesn't portray the exact feeling on the ship. Because, I mean, if you sail on the ship, you're proud to sail here. I mean, the guys that sail here, if you talk badly about the ship, they'll take offense to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is their ship, you know. And they've learned, this is actually not their ship, this is their house, it's their home. Because they're more here than they actually are at home. So the guys are proud of her, and they are proud to sail here, and they are most willing to boast about the ship to the public in any other which way. You know? So the ship is perceived as being an accomplishment, I suppose.
Were you on the vessel when that stabbing incident?
No, luckily not. I was on leave, and I just read about it.
Who was on the vessel?
It was Captain Jonathan Wanless, and Chief Officer was Captain Syndicum. He's master here now.
Syndicum, is that Gavin?
Yeah.
But that must have... It's after that it became a totally dry ship.
Yes. The company already had a 2.5% policy, but the... These guys were drinking more serious liquor, which they got from somewhere, which cannot be explained.
And
whether they pulled it down from the passengers or whether they brought it on from from sailing, I don't know. But
it was an alcohol-fueled incident.
Yes.
Was that just an assumption?
No, that was the easy scapegoat. If you look at those three guys involved, they were convicted criminals somewhere along their life. So if you put three convicted criminals in one space, it's bound to something to happen, whether there's alcohol involved or not. So I think it was a easy way for Smith to finally put a blanket over the whole core policy, which I don't have a problem with because I think it just makes my life easier to manage.
Yes.
You know?
All the research vessels that are dry for passengers as well.
All the ships in our fleet for Smith are dry. They're all dry.
For passengers and officers and crew.
For everyone. It's only the Agalas that still has a...
So why is the Agalas not dry?
I don't know, because DEA doesn't want it to be dry.
Dry.
They want their guys to have the drink. They've got no grounds on not allowing it.
Okay.
But if DEA will make the ship dry, then it'll also make the islands and the ice dry.
I understand.
That makes sense. But that will prevent people from going there, and that will stop the program.
Yeah, no, that would be problematic for
them. It's actually quite sad, because sometimes we do have a perception, you know, there's a lot of drinking happening on these programs. A lot of drinking. And we feel that, you know, we're all trying to do something amazing. And sometimes feel that it's more for the party than anything else.
Yeah.
Maybe you've got a different perception. You've been there now, living with the people, and I don't know what you feel about it.
Well, I definitely think that it should be discouraged a bit more. And
it's too freely available at any time.
Yes.
It should be regulated times, like we've got on the ship.
Times, definitely. But the other thing is, I think it's also South African-specific culture, like the Norwegian base and the German base. They even supply the alcohol. You don't even have to buy it yourself. But the people have a bit more of a self-disciplined culture, if you can call it that.
Right.
So I think it depends on a lot of things. But definitely, also from team to team differs. I know the current team took down a lot less alcohol than the previous team. And they took down like something like 3 containers, and over 1 container was full of milk. So
yeah, they still bought some beers on the ship because they didn't take beers, so they were going to freeze.
I think it depends on situation to situation, but I think the South African culture is definitely it's too much of an inebriation culture.
I agree with you.
And I do also think, though, that there's not that much to do on the ship for passengers.
Yes.
So it's probably one of the reasons.
Yeah, but on the ship it's regulated, but on the islands it's not.
No,
on the islands there's a lot to do, I'm sure. On the ice and on the island.
Sorry?
At the base.
There's lots to do. Yeah, there's no reason there to. My own opinion is there's lots to do on the ship as well. You just have to be creative.
Mm.
It's not really that. I mean, you can read, you can watch movies, you can play board games. There's a hell of a lot to do. You don't really have to be bored.
Yeah, but some people aren't really into all that sort of thing. But on a new ship, I think she'll be a little bit faster, so the travelling time will be less, and she's bigger, so there's more space, there's more exploratory means. The passengers have got 2 lounges, and I think there's more space for... There's a lot of science happening.
A larger gym?
There's a larger gym, there's a sauna. There's a separate gym for the passengers, actually. So, yeah, they've catered for that in some sense.
Okay. But then again, it's supposed to be seen as work, not as a pleasure cruise, anyway.
Exactly. No. But okay, the guys aren't really specifically required to do anything on the ship, but I would think this is the time they prepare their documents after their studies at the base and prepare do certain things. But I mean, the PWD guys...
That's what I was saying. I think in terms of pure science, we've counted, we were like 4 people on base, and that's me included, who's not really a pure scientist. Hard science, like real, there were like only about 3 people who are doing science for themselves.
Which is good, really.
Yeah.
I feel a lot of people can actually be flown into it.
Mm.
You know, I would have reduced the cabins on the space on the new ship to make it thoracic cabins and just keep the oceanographers and some essentials and all on the ship and get all the other people flown in. Because flights are frequenting to the Antarctica now these days.
And it's becoming cheaper.
And
I don't know what it exactly, because there's a lot of numbers floating about. I don't know what it costs to the DA to run this vessel for a day. But if it cuts the voyage time there and back, instead they fly, it might probably
work out the same. Well, it's not gonna cut the voyage time. Voyage time is the voyage time. But it will cut the time that the people have got nothing to do.
But would you have to have 30 days? Is that purely for the oceanography, or is that also so that people can be there on takeover? The 30 days that we actually spend at the ice shelf? Or on the ice? Won't it cut that?
No, it could, yeah. It could, I suppose. But that time will be designated anyways. And it will be independent from the people that are flying in. So it doesn't matter whether the ship goes for a long oceanography cruise or not. The people will be flown out whenever they need to.
Yeah. Other incidents, you weren't involved when the Gallus came to rescue the Oldendorf?
No, I joined directly after that voyage, but that first ice slip in 2001 is when the Oldendorf came out again. And we rendezvoused with them in the ice, and we gave them some new crew and new stock and stores and stuff like that. But no, I wasn't involved with the actual rescue. No, I just read about it and read the logbooks and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. And other ships you've been involved with? It's that one then that you rendezvoused with. Polar Stern you've been on a couple of times.
Yes, Polar Stern I've been on a couple of times.
Fedorov,
Ivan Papanen. Okay, I wasn't on there, but I mean, we've been working with them. But no, actually, I haven't been on any other polar type vessel other than this one.
And the Polar Stern.
The Polar Stern.
What is the duties of the captain on the ship in terms of the passengers? Do you have any duties towards the passengers?
The master position on the ship is a bit of an intriguing one, since the DCO is the coordinating officer and he's actually in charge. So, with regards to the passengers, I am only here to make sure that they don't impede on the safety of the vessel or impede on the safety of themselves or disobey rules. So I'm here to tell them what the rules are and then to enforce the rules. But from a coordinating point of view, it's purely DCO. DCO is in charge of the passengers. If you would do something wrong the previous day, I would go to the DCO and say, what the hell happened there? You know? And then you'll have to report back and find out. And the team leaders. The team leaders are supposed to take care of each and their own team. And then via the DCO, he reports to me with regards to the passengers. And then obviously we take care of the guys and their specific needs and so forth. That's why we've got a purser. The purser is there to make sure that the catering department fulfills the needs of the passengers, whether it's food, water, laundry, those type of things. You know? But from controlling the behavior and controlling their doings and programs and presentations and church services and that sort of things. It's not the master's responsibility.
Okay. And in terms of the environment, do you have any specific mandate in terms of the environment? It's most of the vessels?
Yeah, you're an environmental officer, basically. You must make sure that there's no construing of any rules. I mean, you've got specific rules in MARPOL, which is a publication for any ship at sea. No, any master on any ship is basically environmental officer. So we must make sure that we don't dispose of garbage in the appropriate areas, or when we go into a special area, which is in Antarctica, is a special area, that all other things are retained. But we delegate most of that jobs down to the chief officer, who delegates down to the bosun and the galley staff. So we all work in as a team to make sure that we don't put anything in the engine room, because they can pump over oily water, which is not allowed. So we've got a big bolt holding tank which we use when we're down in the special area.
And then where do you get rid of stuff then, when you're out of the special area?
Yeah, then we've got the oily water separator, which this goes through and it pumps over 15 parts per million of clean, basically clean water. And then the sludge from that is kept on board, and when we get back to Cape Town, it's pumped ashore into a tank liner, which is then disposed of.
In terms of the environment, what are the specific challenges of Southern Ocean seafaring or whatever term
you use? Well, you're at sea for 72 days, and people can generate a hell of a lot of garbage in 72 days. You'd be surprised. So we've got incinerators, we've got compactors, we've got various ways and means of getting fridges for storing slops and those type of things. So, yeah, it's a hell of a challenge to manage the garbage.
Is there any way in which the garbage can be reduced?
Well, I suppose, when we pack our stores, we get rid of all the cardboard and those type of things. We try to get all the plastics in the cardboard before you sell. But human-generated waste is going to be human-generated waste, you know. I mean, but we've got the switch plant taking care of that stuff. We've got the compactors, and we've got the holding tanks for the engine room. So in Antarctica, I can't say we don't. We've got a footprint. Anybody, anything has got a footprint, but it's minimized to almost. It's regulated and it's minimized.
Okay. But I would think that the Agala still have quite a carbon footprint.
Oh yeah, with regards to fuel emissions. Mm. But we've, I mean, on the new ship again, they've moved to tier 2 emissions, which is a very high standard. I mean, we don't burn heavy fuels. We burn a very clean diesel in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And we've got a international air pollution certificate from Lloyd's, which says that our, you know, our things comply to certain
regulations. It could be a lot worse, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, if you burn like the container ships, big sludge, I mean, that solid pieces come up in the air.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes.
Heavy carbon.
So why would you say, is it important for South Africa to have a presence in Antarctica?
That's a very good question. Everybody wants a piece of a pie. You know, when we run out of fossil fuels, I suppose everybody is going to want to explore that as the next area. And then the treaty will go for nothing. Yeah. But I think South Africa needs to be present there, because we are the southern tip of Africa. We are an African leading country. Mm. And we sort of groundbreaking in some of our science.
Mm.
And in some of our things that we do there, we are very good. I think we should have a presence there. We should perhaps even have more of a presence there. Some, like the Germans have got two bases. Russians have got many. And so, but I think, yeah, we're doing a good job there. I think we should stay there. We are in charge of this search and rescue area from Cape Town to Antarctica. So that is
basically the pie-shaped.
Yeah, it's called Nav Area 7. That South Africa is sort of in charge of what they call MRCC, the Maritime Rescue Coordinating Center. There we go. So if something would have happened here, MRCC Cape Town would manage it, even if there's other ships involved or whatever. But we are in charge of the certain. And then, you know, the whole ComNap group is involved to take care of this area.
Have you ever been involved in ComNap?
No. I've just been sailing on the ship as a third party man and manager.
So cool.
And because of my experience on this vessel, I've been kept here. In this, but obviously, I think we have been dealing with it in some sense, because we get ComNap documents, we have to comply to the treaty,
and
so forth. So to some extent.
In terms of previous captains, are there anyone that you know about or that you learned a lot from?
Well,
previous masters, sorry.
Well, Captain Dave Hall that is here now is basically my mentor. You know, he's... We've started pretty much at the same time here, but he was already a senior master at that stage. He's already retired from port control. And it's a noble guy that one can learn a lot from, and he's quite willing to teach. So I think I've learned a lot from him, but also once I got qualified, I learned a lot from myself. You know, I mean, you get faced with many challenges, especially on an older ship and the conditions that we go through, and you just learn and read and experience. And you know, I don't think anybody can accelerate the training program at sea, because experience is something that you can't you can't replace. But yeah.
Would you like to share Marion and Antarctica with your family? Take them along sometime.
Yes, I would love to do that. My wife has been down to Neumeier in 2003.
Was she flown down?
No, she came on the ship. We did a Sinai cruise, and then on the Neumeier she came with.
Shorter cruise.
But she gets very seasick, so she'll be joining me for future ventures. But a couple of months ago actually, when we did the Women in Maritime voyage, both my two daughters and my wife came with me on the ship from Cape Town to PE, which they enjoyed thoroughly, but they were all seasick.
Okay.
Which is quite sad. We had quite bad weather as well.
Do you like Antarctica?
Yeah.
Why?
It's different. It's challenging. It's a specialty. It's like, I suppose, if you want to call, why do you like history? You know what I mean? It's a speciality that I enjoy.
Mm.
You know, I like shipping, but I would prefer to do shipping with a bit of a challenge.
Okay, so do you think you will continue doing this as your career option? Shipping,
yes.
In
I don't
uncharted
think
waters, if you can call it that.
Yes.
Or lesser charted waters.
Yes. I think I will serve on a new ship perhaps for a while, and then I will try to take my experience and pass it on to other people in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Like teaching, or I want to move ashore because I feel I owe it to my daughters.
Yes,
to be ashore sometime.
One of the last questions. South Africa, would you agree to the statement that it's not really a maritime nation?
Yes. It's not really a maritime nation. If you go into the public and you talk about the bridge of the ship, who will be wondering, and they won't be picturing the control centers from the top where people stand and look out of the window from.
Why would you think that is, though? Because the Cape of Good Hope played such an important role in maritime history in general.
I don't know. I think it's there's a lack of awareness, like pretty much everything else. I mean, South Africa is coming up steadily on awareness of modern technology and certain things, but okay, seafaring is not a modern thing. Seafaring is ancient, and we've got a massive coastline. So there's not actually a reason why we shouldn't be more of a maritime nation. But I think we just act as a middle post, you know. There's massive ships sailing from Cape Town, but they come from first world countries, and they just pass by here to either pick up stock, pick up people, or pick up bunkers, you know. So If the government would perhaps introduce cabbage laws where they say, right, there will be a single big port where all big ships come to, and from there it will be transshipped to smaller coastal vessels, which and then regulate them to be South African flag vessels, because we only have one passenger vessel on the South African flag and
really?
We're sitting on it.
Oh.
We only have three large vessels on the South African register. And I think it's the result of that that it's not causing us. If we had more ships, we had more people at sea, people would be more aware of it. But we don't.
So honestly, where's the pleasure cruises things? Where are they registered in?
Well, the pleasure cruises,
those big MSCs.
Well, no, they will be registered with proper authority, in Britain perhaps, or in America.
Yeah, probably not South African owned, anyway.
But you get setups where you've got what they call flags of convenience, like the Bahamas and those places, where the government, because when you register at a certain place, you are regulated by that place. Like we regulated in the South African, the South African Merchant
Act.
The Merchant Shipping Act. But now, the Bahamas, they don't enforce that many rules. You know, they don't check the ships out. The ships are normally in a bad condition, and the crew are paid poorly, and people are just trying to make money on the sly. So that's what they call them, flags of convenience. But there's a whitelist out of countries that do provide the proper regulations, and South Africa is part of it, you know.
Yeah.
So we actually do.
But
it's not attractive for shipping companies to register the vessels in South Africa because it's expensive. And it's heavily regulated.
Mm. And is it regulated to the extent that the crew here must be South African?
No, this is a DEA clause.
Okay.
Smith can get the contract and work on with this vessel, but they want South African crew.
Is the crew South African?
Mostly.
No.
They either have permanent residence or South African passports or something like that. Yeah.
Okay.
Because we do have some Congolese, and I mean, you must know.
Yeah, that's what I asked.
Yeah.
But they not. I mean, it's not different than any other South African kind of hospitality industry where you get people with permanent residency.
Exactly, yeah.
What would you like to call the new ship?
Mandela.
Okay.
I think so, because, you know, he's an idol, isn't he?
Mm.
He's done a lot for us, for everyone. And I think the country owes it to him.
Mm.
And his legacy will live a little bit on, you know. And yeah, I think so.
Good. Thank you.
Pleasure.